Hello there, and welcome to my podcast. This is the D-Lew Show, Sports and a Slice of Life. Excited about this new project. You can subscribe on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Also follow us on a weekly basis on DaveLewisOnTheAir.com. Guest today is Bill Herenda. Many of you folks know him as professional basketball insider, college basketball analyst. What you may not know, he's a national champion. What you may not know, he's on his way to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, if he continues on this trajectory. So without further ado, the great Bill Herenda. I've got you as an NBA contributor, college basketball analyst, morning sports anchor on KFBK Sacramento, and also aspiring hand model. Have I got that right?
That's right. Yes, you got it.
Hey, for those who follow Bill on Bill Herenda on Twitter, you've got massive admiration for Hubie Brown. You're always quoting his telecasts and making notes about what Hubie said about this and that. What is it about him as a basketball guy that you find so enticing?
Well, you know what, Dave, you'll not be surprised that I'm so shallow. The fact that he's from New Jersey, number one, is near and dear to my heart. But no, I just think that, you know, like so many people, my affinity for Hubie stems from his ability to stay away from obfuscation, you know, and that being making the simple complex. He keeps it so simple and explains the game in terms that are easily digestible and understandable. The breadth and depth of his knowledge, the preparation that comes through the passion for, you know, now an octogenarian with so much energy and love for the game, I find myself gravitating towards games that he's broadcasting. Say when you have a choice during the regular season, I'll actually watch a game that he's doing. And I think this may be the number one reason why I'm such a big Hubie Brown guy, is that every time I watch a game or I listen to a podcast that he's on, I'm learning something about the game that I didn't know prior. So, and I think it's that insatiable desire to, you know, improve as a broadcaster, to learn the game, that really drives my respect for Hubie. And I know that I'm not alone in that. And I also find him, you know, just entertaining just from the standpoint of the diction, like late in the game, you'll appreciate this, the other night with Oklahoma City and Utah, he's like, so can somebody foul somebody here? He's like, you know, in a gym or a schoolyard with some very familiar refrains. So that's in part why I'm so such a big Hubie student of the professor, as I call him. And I do call him the professor that you stay to listen to after the class bell has rung.
That's pretty high praise. Now, do you try to incorporate some of those techniques in what you do? I've worked with you in college basketball, you know, St. Mary's and some high school stuff as well. So do you feel like you're a Hubie protege?
Well, I think so. And here's what I try to do is definitely give Hubie credit for things that are, you know, either statistics or things that he'll track on that he owns. You know what I mean? Like if he owns it, then I'll definitely give him credit for it. For example, if you define pace as simply the number of possessions per game, and that's a beautiful, simplistic description of it that I learned from Mike Fratello. And then Hubie Brown frequently says, if you play at a slow pace, what's so important? Shooting a high percentage, because possessions are not in abundance. They're so few. So, you know, Dave, so what I'll do is certainly give Hubie Brown credit, or Mike Fratello, or Tim Capstra, the Brooklyn Nets radio analyst that I love to listen to, along with Chris Carino, the great play-by-play guy there, all friends of mine, give them credit. But I think where the improvement comes from is in the preparation. And some of the things that if you listen to different podcasts that Hubie has done, he'll delve into his preparation for the games, which, you know, one quick example is simply to have historical knowledge of the matchup in case the game is a blowout. So we can look up at the rafters and see Greg Bunch's jersey or Reggie Theus's jersey in case the game gets away from us and there's other topics that we can cover to engage the viewer. And again, to me, there's just nothing bigger than the game. UB's not bigger than the game. You know, we're certainly not bigger than the game. It's the game itself. So I think where I most incorporate things is in, yes, learning about the game and translating that and incorporating it, but also in, I think it's taken my preparation to I've always cared deeply about it, but probably to a more effective level in what I've learned from him and from others too.
And take about maybe 75% of it and never get it in the game, which a lot of times we happen. In case we do get to a blowout, then you get to bring in some of those nuggets.
Yeah. And you know, David, I think that goes back to just that simple point of your job, at which you do so well as a play-by-play guy, is to tell us what is going on. And you do that with such great panache, preparation, and you're able to do that in such a terrific way. It makes my job so easy because all I'm there to do is tell people why it's happening. Whatever's happening on the floor, that's my primary job, is to say why. And as we know, to have a great broadcast, which we always strive for, it's the guys in the truck that are producing and directing that are so vital to this team that we have, that's so similar to the guys on the floor. That's what we're trying to emulate, is that cohesion, that teamwork, that we over me mentality, and recognizing that it's the viewer who's most important. And certainly I think there are times both on radio and TV that the best thing to do, particularly for me as the analyst, is to say nothing and just let the crowd, let the noise tell the story, even if it's on radio for a bit, and certainly if it's on TV. Because there's nothing I can add. I can only detract from those moments. And certainly, those are moments that I want to, just as we say in the industry, right, just to lay out and let be quiet.
And that's where the director, great producer, that they really make that happen then during our time where we are laying out with the great pictures and the cuts and the crowd reaction, et cetera.
Sure. So many parallels. As you know, you think about a game that you broadcast, and it's so similar to playing or coaching, where, you know, certain nights you'll feel pretty good about it. And then you'll think about, well, this moment was probably germane for this statistic and I failed to mention it, or I just didn't play as well as I could have, or you feel pretty good about it. Hey, I thought that was good. That was an entertaining broadcast. Everyone seemed happy with it. So there are so many parallels, because I think it's something that you can never master. And it just kind of keeps your appetite going because, you know, you're just striving to be as good as you can be, again, not just individually, but certainly collectively, to have the best show that you possibly can. And let's face it, these guys that work so hard, they make it easy for us. I mean, they're just laying it all on the floor, and every game takes on a personality of its own. And it's just I'm just really delighted to be still involved and still a small part of the game.
At the time of this recording, we're in the second round of the NBA playoffs, and LeBron James pulled off another miracle. Not a miracle, because we almost expect that from him. Is it possible that he is underappreciated with all that he's doing, with these 45, 46-point games, game-winning threes at the buzzer? You take it for granted.
You know what? Yeah, you know what, Dave, is interesting. I think it probably depends upon who you talk to. He's such a polarizing guy, and I've never really understood the LeBron detractors. But maybe you're right in that now at this stage of the game, even his biggest detractors have to appreciate the longevity and the production that he has, and also the combination of the physicality, his ability to continue to absorb contact, to put up prodigious numbers. I think, you know, he probably is underappreciated, and when he will be fully appreciated is probably that first season that he's not around. Because he is, you know, like, I don't know if once in a generation is the right term, or, you know, but he's certainly one of the elites to ever play, if not the best to play the game. And what he does on pretty much a regular basis is absolutely, absolutely phenomenal. I mean, even I you know, pride myself on having a strong vocabulary, run out of superlatives when it comes to LeBron.
Who do you like coming out of the East? It's so wide open this year.
I really like Toronto. And, you know, I, in the beginning, before it started, I thought that it would be Toronto and Houston, and that Toronto would fall in seven games, that Houston would win it. And the reason why, I think it's just easy, for example, to, I wouldn't say willy-nilly, but just to say, hey, I think the Warriors are going to win it. Of what value is that? But I don't really feel that in my gut, although they've looked pretty good, of course. But I just feel like the reason why Toronto will come out of the East is just that, you know, an assistant coach, Nick Nurse, on Dwayne Casey's staff changed their shot spectrum, and they started to minimize tough twos in training camp and amplify threes and give those points actually more credit in their scrimmages. So, of course, we've seen that change for them. And certainly we've seen Toronto with their deep bench, and now Van Vliet is back, who gives them a boost. And I just feel like the change, the roster turnover with Cleveland leaves them especially vulnerable. And out of the West, my feeling with Houston is just that this is something that, and I think it's quite similar to the Warriors, that I've always said that the offense for the Warriors is the sizzle, but the steak is really their defense. And when you see Houston go from 18th in defensive rating to 6th, and Jeff Bizdelic's his Bible, if you will, on transition defense, which I won't bore your audience with, and the addition of P.J. Tucker and the physicality that he brings, Bahamute, I just think that perhaps Houston can capitalize on Curry's injury, and he'll be back, as we know. Looks like he may be back tomorrow night in game 2 against New Orleans. But that's just my gut, Dave, in that I think this could be a Houston-Toronto final, and that it would be Houston in 7. And again, I'm not Nostradamus, but I did say this before the playoffs began. That was my gut as to what would occur.
That certainly sounds like a matchup that would make the network drool with Toronto and Houston, right, with the market sizes.
You know what? Well, the business aspect. I always say this, Dave. You know, I'm like Paulie from Goodfellas. Remember the scene where they're trying to convince Paulie to buy the restaurant? And he's like, what do I know about a restaurant? I sit down, I order my spaghetti and meatballs, and I enjoy it. So, like, all this business stuff, you know, ratings and this, that, and the other thing, is really, like, over my head. So I think that, you know, obviously there's so many intriguing teams and matchups, and injuries play a big part of it, of course. And, you know, that's one of UB Brown's big deals in the playoffs, of course, is, you know, can you play? Are you injury free? Can you finish over the last 6 minutes of the game? Can you effectively get your three top scorers in the areas where they can be effective tonight, where they've been effective tonight, where they can be effective? And the final 6 minutes, can you finish? Those being the pillars. So I think we have a lot of, you know, really cool dynamic storylines. And so many great young players. You know, you talk about LeBron, and now we've got Simmons, and I know Jaylen Brown's got the hamstring. We'll see if he plays tonight in game 1 against Philly. But Tatum has been so good.
Terry Rozier.
Rozier has been great. And although Giannis is out of it, but – you know, Gobert in and of himself is an immense talent. So anyway, I think it's just very exciting. I mean, it's always been an exciting time being around basketball, but particularly now with the game, the way the game has changed and the emphasis on driving to the basket, that being a high percentage shot, corner threes, threes in general, and then kind of eschewing the tough twos and then getting to the free throw line, still a very effective way to score. But some of the analytics, it's just fascinating really to watch, you know, the talent and try to learn from you know, coaches and analysts and what have you. It's just so much fun, all these matchups.
You're viewed...
I apologize if I'm having enjoying this nut buddy here.
No, I'll do the fill while you're taking the sip. Hey, you're viewed as an NBA guy, NBA contributor, but you've got a great college basketball history. You do games for ESPN, Mountain West. I've worked with you in the West Coast Conference. You come from UMass Lowell, where you won a Division II national championship back when they were the Chiefs, I guess, right? 1988. What do you recall about that time?
Well, first of all, Dave, I have to invoke the great Connie Hawkins. In the older we get, the better we were.
Yep.
So that's number one. No, you know what? I was just always really fortunate. You know, I played high school basketball at St. Peter's Prep in Jersey City for one of the all-time great coaches in Jerry Halligan, who, you know, kind of before there was Bob Hurley, it was Jerry Halligan and other great coaches. But Jerry was absolutely terrific, an absolute father figure for me and my teammates. And, you know, so we had great players there, from Gavin Cummings to John Stokes to Carlton Rogers to Arvin Todd to Ernie Redwine. And I'll get in trouble here. You know, you always leave somebody out, right?
Yeah.
But we had great players, great kids at Prep, and it was a terrific league. And, you know, we were playing against guys like David Rivers, who was at St. Anthony's and played at Notre Dame and for the Lakers, and Kenny Wilson at Villanova, and Patty Laguerre at St. Mary's, and Kenny Coleman, who went to Jacksonville and New Haven, and Darryl Wilson at Ferris, who went to Florida State. So I found myself playing with and competing against some terrific players. And, you know, you'd scrimmage at White Eagle Hall. Coach Hurley was so magnanimous to allow us to come over to the bingo hall that was legendary in Jersey City, even though we didn't go to St. Anthony's, but go in there and scrimmage. And at that time, you know, you're looking to be Digger Phelps and Raleigh Massimino and, you know, all these college coaches, and you'd be playing against the best and the best in the city. So fast forward to Lowell. I went up there, and Gavin Cummings, one of my high school teammates, we went up there together. He decided very early on in our senior year to go there, put zero pressure on me. I was actually considering going to Columbia, but I couldn't get in. They wanted me to do another year of prep school, and I always kidded around my friends. I couldn't get into Columbia with a search warrant. So I, you know, contemplated staying local and going to Columbia. But again, at Lowell, it worked out great. Great players. Leo Parent was the MAC freshman of the year at Manhattan, played for Gordy Chiesa, and transferred back to Lowell for family and academic and basketball reasons. And we just caught, you know, things at the exact right time, got on a tear, won the national championship. It was actually the first time the school had qualified for the NCAA tournament in Division II, and we ended up winning the whole thing. So anyway, it gives me a great appreciation, not for the result, but for the effort, for the journey. And people don't realize the blood, sweat, and tears, the sacrifice that is involved from the players to the coaches to the training staff to the administration, the people responsible for feeding you and the travel. And so and you got to get a little bit lucky to win. And so anyway, for me, it just kind of boils down to how much I love and admire the process and all the people that are involved with that. So it gives me, I think, really good perspective on what it's like to coach, because my brother was actually an assistant coach up there for 2 years. And one of those was my freshman year at Lowell. And he's been a longtime college coach, is now a head coach at FDU. And then there were guys from that era, like Steve Clifford, now the erstwhile Charlotte Hornets head coach, who was just fired. Tom Thibodeau, the current Timberwolves assistant coach. Bill Baino, who I played against, is an assistant with Nate McMillan in Indiana. So anyway, so it just gives me great pride to see these guys succeed and do well, and I think it gives me a good appreciation for players and what their lives are like and what it's like to prepare and kind of try to be impervious to the distractions and focus on the task at hand for those, you know, 40 minutes or 48 minutes.
Does it blow you away that it's been 30 years since Pat King had blood gushing out of his chin in that national semifinal, that this happened so long ago?
Yeah. You know, Dave, your research is incredible. But yeah, it is. Time is you know, I just heard a caller call into Sirius XM NBA radio, and he said, "Father Time never loses," which I thought was a great quote. And those guys like Pat King, Bobby Licari was a great point guard. Brian Prath was a terrific shooting guard. Mike Skoka went to St. Joe's in Metuchen and played up in Lowell. And, of course, Carl Anthony Towns, and Marcus Towns, who plays for Loyola Chicago, who played for my brother at FDU in the NCAA tournament a couple of years ago, and then goes back on a Final Four run with Loyola. I have a real hard time with it, Dave, because I feel like I'm still 21. Like, I don't feel any differently. I mean, I may not be able to, you know, go and run a mile in the time I would at that stage of the game. But yeah, it is phenomenal how time waits for no one. And I just can't, I can't reconcile the time that has gone by since we were in college and, you know, had some pretty good success playing. It's hard for me to wrap my head around that, because I just feel, you know, I feel like I'm still a kid, but I guess I'm not.
A lot of folks have the list of cliches about what sports teach them, life lessons, whether it's teammate, perseverance, you know, whatever it is, any of those things that, you know, ring true to you from your time at Lowell that you've applied to your life, whether it's husband and father or business person, whatever.
Yeah, I think that, how do I say this the right way? I think that at that stage of the game, that was your identity. You know what I mean? Like, your game was your identity, and the success or lack thereof was how you defined yourself. And I'm okay with that, because I think that you have to have absolute commitment to be good at it, to be, you know, so you have to have that type of confidence. And you talk about pro players, and you've got to have that type of confidence to get to that level. And I think the lessons that I learned at St. Peter's Prep and at UMass Lowell, you know what, they've cut through every aspect of my life, professionally, like you said, family wise. And I think the biggest thing that I really learned was perseverance, to stick with it through those difficult days. And there are days that you don't feel like going to the gym, you don't want to, but you have to. And I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten probably more patient in recognizing that it is a marathon, it's not a sprint, and probably a finer appreciation for that. But I would say that perseverance is the biggest lesson. I had my shoulder operated on after my junior year. I heard it my freshman year. And that was kind of a tough rehab and what have you. But you look at every guy that had certain obstacles that they had to overcome to be a productive member of that team or any team. And now, with my teammates, I'll look and, you know, we're in touch. And thank God, everybody's in really good shape. But there are guys that have had, you know, their knees scoped multiple times, or, you know what I mean? So I think those lessons can continue. And, you know, like anything else, you just, I think you have to leave it all on the floor every day. And one of the questions I ask myself frequently now is, what have I learned? What have I learned today at night before I go to bed that I can apply tomorrow, whether it's my sports updates or that next game or what have you? What have I accumulated knowledge wise? So, you know, now I try to be a big learner, and not only for academic sake, but how can I incorporate this and how can I help? And that takes the form of not just broadcasting, but, you know, I kidded around with Steve Clifford. I did a radio interview in Charlotte a couple of years ago, and literally within a week, Michael Jordan extended his contract. So I said, Steve, if I knew that was going to happen, I would have done the interview a lot sooner.
Yep.
But, you know, if I can help any coach that's, you know, a buddy of mine at any level with, hey, have you seen this? You know, like Ben Cohen from the Wall Street Journal did a great piece recently. And now, I talked earlier about 3-point shooting and eschewing the tough twos, but he did a great piece on the Warriors and at their proficiency this season at making shots in the mid-range and inside the 3-point line. Now, why is that occurring? Probably because everyone in the league is pushing them off the 3-point line, or at least trying to. So anyway, it's a long answer, but if I can find information that perhaps my friends in the coaching business haven't seen or haven't thought about, that in a way makes me feel good. You know what I mean? To try to pass along some tidbits or nuggets that I found, because you know, no one has time to find everything. So it just makes me feel good. And I think that's kind of some of the residue from playing, is just kind of like that continual improvement and perseverance. So
I came across a great quote from Nelson Mandela as I'm trying to get ready for this dance contest, right? I'm either going to lose or not lose. But his quote was, I never lose. I either win or I learn something. I thought that's a great way to live. If you can adopt that in life, you know, you're going to go places.
That is terrific. That's perfect, Dave. I love it. I love it.
You keep that one in mind. You're a Renaissance guy. You've spent some time in Hollywood, so you're not just an announcer and a NBA analyst, but but you're a body double, hand model. Get us up to speed on what you're doing with that, Bill Herenda.
You know what, Dave? I have done some of that stuff, and it's kind of interesting. I did a commercial that was – I was a body double for a golfer, and part of it was the fact that I had to make some putts. Now, I golf. I'm not a great golfer, but I love the game. I love it, and I don't play that often, but I do love it. But I guess what struck me about this aspect of the world is – just the punctilious nature of how these commercials are shot. So, you know, how do I say it the right way? Like, for example,
I'm going to look up that word, by the way, while you go ahead and continue. Punctilious.
And Dave, I am probably killing your audience. You know, what was it? Edward Bennett Williams, the owner of the Washington Redskins, told George Allen. He said, he spoke about George Allen. He said, I gave him an unlimited expense account, and he exceeded it. I feel like I'm doing that with my answers for you. but for example, Dave, if you watch a commercial and
showing great attention to detail or correct behavior.
There you go.
Punctilious.
There you go. But there's such a great attention to that. And for example, if there's a shot with, say, someone pressing an elevator button, or putting, right? Or anything that involves your hands, you have to kind of reenact how the primary person that you're body doubling for initiated that action so that it's consistent and there's continuity in the shot. So anyway, those things I find quite interesting and challenging to do. And as you've done, you know, like some voiceover work that creates its own set of fun and opportunity and challenges and what have you. But yeah, the whole body double thing is quite interesting. And I have to say that I did putt quite well, to the delectation of the crew, because you know how it goes. If you're trying to get these things done, it's a little bit chilly on the golf course and they want to get it in as few takes as possible. I was happy that I putted quite well on that particular occasion, which was fortuitous, but we were all lucky for that.
Did they correct you on the putting strokes? Hey, you know, his hand, his left hand is here, his right hand is here, you know, do it again.
No, you know what, Dave? Ironically, that part of it, I didn't get any instruction. However, there were, for example, if I had to take the ball. This is a good question. Here's a good example. I had to take the ball out of the cup with kneeling, you know, and you know how it goes. You never kneel on a golf course. Like, you know what I mean? Your knee doesn't hit the green. You know what I mean? But you kind of kneel down to get the ball. So I had to kneel, get the ball with my right, take the flag stick with my left, put it in with my left. You know what I'm saying?
That's
so
amazing.
So there I got specific coaching. So it's just kind of wild. Like some things that you never think of. And now now I think I'm an expert. I'll watch commercials and I'll say, well, hey, was that may have been a body double in that particular shot. You know, now I'm a director. Now I'm Scorsese, right? I do a little bit of work. Well, but anyway, but it's fun to, I think to, and here, I mean, come on. I'm preaching to the choir as someone who's been in movies and what have you, but it has been fun to just kind of dabble in some different things that are a little bit broader and outside of, you know, just the basketball or sports realm. So
how do you get picked as a body double? I mean, did you have to take off your shirt and they say, hey, you look just like him?
No, you know what? I think in this particular case, you know, Dave, you can relate to this. I think it's just height, build, like all those basic things. You know what I mean? That does that make sense? So listen, I think in everything in life, and I guess the older I get, the more I appreciate this, you just got to be you. You just got to be you and let the chips fall where they may. And for something like that, though, I think in the eyes of the casting people, I think it's really more, you know, certainly if I was going to be a body double for a cello player, okay, maybe I get excluded early on because I don't have a lot of musical talent or ability. And, you know, so in other words, I think you've got to be able to putt in a kind of a natural way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't be able to grab a cello and in a way that a musician would grab it. You know what I mean? So I think that there are those attributes that, you know, height, build, I didn't have to worry about any voice situation here, but those are kind of the type of things. I think they just kind of, you know, just kind of try to match you up as best as possible.
If you could be the ultimate body double, you know, who would you sub for?
I'm not interested in that now, Dave. I'm interested in who's going to body double for me.
Oh, yeah. No. Who would you body double for? I mean, I look right now at your resume. It says you were the body double for The Rock in San Andreas. Is that true?
I can't. I sign all these NDAs. I can't say who yeah, I would right. body double for.
Well, here's another one. Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise. That was you?
Well, hey, anything's possible. I'll neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, right.
Hey, what's I'm trying to think of who, like, you know what? De Niro. I automatically think of De Niro. You know, my favorite movie scene of all time is, Dave? My favorite movie scene of all time is The Godfather when Pacino has got the jaw wired, right? The cop has popped him, and he's sitting in the chair, and he says, and I won't do the whole thing because I can't. I don't have it by memory, but he says, oh, they want to meet, right? They want to meet with me in a public place. They go on and on. And notice how the camera zooms in on Pacino. And then ultimately, right, he says, I'll kill them both. And then Sonny's like, oh, a big college boy in a fancy suit. You're going to get your brains on your suit. Bada bing, bada boom. This is not, you know, the war. But anyway, so if I had to think of body doubles or who I'd body double for, you know, could I body double for De Niro or Pacino? Those are the guys that I, you know, or James Caan. Those are the guys that I automatically gravitate towards, in my mind at least.
What about romantic comedies? Let's say Hugh Grant in Notting Hill. You're in front of Julia Roberts, and she says, "I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love her."
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm not sure if I'm ready to go there yet.
Yeah.
But it was funny. Before we even got into this, I got into Goodfellas, right? And Paulie with the restaurant. So yeah, I'm not sure if I'm ready to tackle romantic comedies yet.
Well,
that one I haven't seen, so I don't know. But hey, why put a ceiling on anything?
What about Dirty Dancing, Patrick Swayze?
No, you know what? I don't think I could do that. And Dave, I give you so much credit. I mean, you look terrific. And like you said, was it Gandhi you quoted earlier?
That was Mandela.
Mandela. So like, Dave, if you don't win, you and your partner, like you said, you have learned a lot. You look great. What a tremendous – I'm so excited for you. And I'm not surprised because that's how you attack everything that you do with great joy and passion, mindfulness, and competition. There you go. You're like a Steve Kerr guy with the Warriors. But seriously, no, I'm very proud of you, but I am not the least bit surprised because that's how you attack everything. You look great. I see the clips of your progress on Instagram and all the social media platforms. So I don't know if I could pull that off. I really don't.
Bill's talking about Dancing with the Tri-Valley Stars, which will be on May 12th in Livermore, and I'm one of the contestants. You mentioned Steve Kerr. There's that phrase he uses, appropriate fear, which is what I have in this competition because it is audience voting. So, you know, if somebody brings 100 of their groupies and I could be the best dancer and still lose, I could be the worst dancer and win. So, you know, I don't know how I'm approaching this in terms of winning or losing. It's just really the experience and getting better doing something.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what, Dave, I'm remiss. You know, we talked about UMass Lowell earlier and I mentioned my high school coach, Jerry Halligan. You know, I played for Don Doucette at UMass Lowell, who was a terrific coach. And he went on to coach North Carolina Asheville, who we had this season against St. Mary's, and Chaminade and other places. And, you know, listen, at the time, we didn't always see eye to eye. You know what I mean? We would butt heads and what have you. But I really owe a ton to Coach Doucette, Paul Faison, John Paganetti, who are all part of the staff there at UMass Lowell. And, you know, he was kind of, like we mentioned earlier, Thibodeau and Clifford. And then before that, it was like John Killalay, who was a New England guy, who was an assistant with the Milwaukee Bucks. And Killalay was actually, I think, with the Celtics before that. So anyway, so I'm forever indebted to Deuce for all of his support. And he's, you know, I wasn't highly recruited. And he was another guy, he was a guy who, you know, you could point to in life that, hey, this guy believed in me. And not only myself, but all my team, like every guy on that team had detractors and doubters. Like they'd say, Herenda, they thought you were too slow. Lecarrie, they thought you were too small. Cummings, they thought you were a head case. I remember getting reamed out after a loss, and they went down, the coaching staff went down the list, in all of us. So finally, we get to the showers. I'm trying not to laugh because I know we're going to be good and we're going to bounce from this. But I'm trying not to laugh. And finally, we get to the locker room and to the showers where I'm at it. They can't hear us. And I'm like, hey, they may have been right about everybody, but Cummings, they may have been wrong about everybody, but they were right about you. You are a head case. But so that was just another, I think, lesson is that, you know, you've got to have, you know, that impervious nature. You got to believe in yourself individually and collectively that we can get this done. I think that was another major lesson there because, you know, we just weren't heavily recruited, but a lot of sniffs for sure. You know, but there was just that, you know, I don't know, a little bit of trepidation from a lot of the quote, you know, a lot of the quote experts. So that's a very gratifying feeling when you're still playing and a lot of people that passed on you are, you know, headed to the golf course. So that's another, you know, kind of a good feeling. So
next time I talk to you, you mentioned, you know, teamwork and all the stuff with, your experience, and in life you need your team, you need your family, you need your wife and your daughter, and I love your family. I can't wait to talk to you next time about you know, maybe strategy that I can maybe pull a nugget out of as a husband or father, and also some college basketball stuff since we're connected with St. Mary's and about the future of mid-majors, etc. So agree to come on again, please.
Dave, anytime. My pleasure. This has been terrific, and I look forward to seeing you in the dance competition and seeing you with your with all of your guests. I think it's a great forum for people to see you in a different way, right? In a more relaxed way that doesn't have the time constraints with your other work. And again, I don't think you'll have many guests as loquacious as I am. And we'll all be watching today. But thanks so much for having me. It's been a blast. Anytime.
So follow Bill Herenda on Twitter at Bill Herenda. What about Facebook or Instagram?
Yeah. I'm on there, Dave. Yeah. Just, I believe Instagram is just at Bill Herenda as well. And if you do a quick search on Facebook, you'll find me. I'm not exactly sure what. I am on there, though. So I'm kind of ubiquitous throughout the social media stuff and trying to. That's the other thing, Dave, too. Just trying to share whatever I can learn. And if that makes somebody's day a little bit better, knowing what the keys could be for the Celtics and the Sixers tonight, that they're both top five in defensive rating and the Celtics are top 10 in not only 3-point field goal percentage, but attempts and makes. And then it kind of, you know, maybe folks find value in that and they can enjoy the game more. I'm happy to provide. So that's a little bit of a sample or slice of what you may see on my Twitter page and Twitter account.
Well, you've made my day better just by spending a few minutes to talk. So I appreciate it, my friend.
You're too kind. My pleasure, Dave. Anytime. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks to Bill Herenda, and thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.